science and religion, Stephen Jay Gould once said, were separate magisteria, distinct realms of human understanding. Science tells us how the natural world works, and religion guides us how to behave. But are there areas where they do overlap, ways in which they inform each other? I'm Seth Shostak, and this is Are We Alone?
I'm Molly Bentley. Many science and religious discussions these days are polarized, each side defending its interpretation of the world and, in the process, sometimes belittling the other. But if we step back from the battle, we may not solve the problem of peaceful coexistence between science and religion, but we may find out if one magisterium might supply useful information on the other.
In this hour, the scientific case against the existence of God and experiencing religious ecstasy through scientific discovery.
Also, the anthropological roots of religious belief, and could an intelligent design theory ever be scientific? Plus, a creationist spin on a natural history museum.
But first,
there's little ambiguity in the title of Victor Stenger's book about the existence of God. In fact, he'd be no good as a crime writer because you could say he gives away the ending. God, the Failed Hypothesis, the cover reads, How Science Shows That God Does Not Exist. In it, Victor Stenger draws on cosmology and physics to form a conclusion which he says is beyond any reasonable doubt. He told Seth why the existence of an omniscient deity is within the purview of science.
The point is that God, that most people worship, is involved in the universe in a very important way, affects everybody's lives, is concerned with everything that happens, reads every thought, and that such a God should have effects on the physical universe. If that God exists, we should know about it, and if that God doesn't exist, then we should not see the effects of the God. So it's an important thing to know about the nature of the universe, whether there's a God or not.
So you don't buy Stephen Jay Gould's argument these are separate magisteria, and using the techniques of one to investigate the reality of the other is simply inappropriate.
Well, practically everybody that reviewed Gould's book said the same thing, and that what he was doing was trying to redefine religion as moral philosophy. Now, if he could do that, if religion was willing to do that, say, okay, we're really just moral philosophy, we have nothing to say about nature, then maybe you could do that. But even that, I doubt, is possible, because it seems to me that behavior of human beings, which, of course, is part of a picture that we're talking about when we're talking about morals and values, that behavior is an observable thing, certainly a subject that science has something to say about. So I don't see how you can escape the fact that science has much to say about the existence of an important God, a God that plays an important role in the universe.
Well, let's investigate that in detail a little bit, because you write that, quote, science has advanced sufficiently to be able to make a definitive statement on the existence or non-existence of God, unquote. What particular scientific advancements did you have in mind that make this possible?
Well, let me just mention one. I think the book covers a whole series of arguments, including arguments based on scriptures and the absence of physical evidence for what people believe to have happened in the scriptures. But perhaps the most unique thing that I have to say has to do with cosmology. Now we have a pretty good model of how the universe began and the Big Bang and the early period of inflation. And if you trace that back to the earliest possible moment, which is called the Planck time, 10 to the minus 43 seconds, the universe was in total chaos. It was absolute maximum entropy. And that means that there could have been no structure or order in the universe at that time. So even if there were a creator, the universe has preserved no memory of that creator. So this is virtually a proof that a creator doesn't exist. The only type of God, actually, that is allowed, it seems to me, by this argument, is the God that Einstein didn't want to have anything to do with, namely the God that plays dice. The God might have started it all up by creating this chaos, but there's no piece of information in a situation of maximum entropy that tells us anything about that God or any of his intentions, so we might as well have not existed.
Well, you've suggested that there might be room here for a God, and a God that has effects on us, because you've distinguished that God from another type of God that is simply completely hands-off, if you will, a God of intention, that might have come in after the Big Bang. I mean, that brings up the question of why the universe is so finely tuned for life. This is an argument that surfaces routinely, regularly, and vigorously, saying that, doggone it, you know, if we change the properties of the universe a little bit, we wouldn't be here discussing them. And this almost sounds like an argument for a God coming in afterward, after the chaotic beginning, and setting things up so that it produced us.
Well, you know, there are a number of reasons why the fine-tuning argument fails. The most important reason is that we have no way of knowing what kind of life might be possible with some different set of parameters. I've played that game a little myself. Other people have, or have changed the parameters of the universe. For example, I found that I can change the current parameters by 10 orders of magnitude, and you still get long-lived stars. And when you have long-lived stars, you've got the first important ingredient for the evolution of life is just enough time for life to evolve.
So, are you saying that the universe isn't so finely tuned then?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's kind of silly when you think about it. Why would a God create a universe that had an important role for humanity and then have to fine-tune the universe so that life could evolve? Why shouldn't it be congenial to life? Why shouldn't people be able to live in space without any oxygen? I think God could have done that, but instead he made the universe a very unfriendly place to life. I know this is probably part of your story at SETI. I mean, the fact that the universe is so evidently unfriendly, even the Earth is unfriendly to life when you think about it. We have two-thirds of the surface of the Earth we can't live on. We're stuck to a tiny layer near the surface. We have all these natural disasters that kill people. We have ultraviolet light, which gives us cancer. There's all kinds of ways in which you could see even the Earth is not fine-tuned for life. The universe is the same.
You say it's actually not so suitable for life, but the facts are that, yes, life can only exist in relatively few of the environments that the universe offers, but the universe is large enough to accommodate a lot of life. So whether you say that's friendly for life or unfriendly for life, that sounds like a kind of a value judgment. What about the intelligent design argument? How do you feel about that?
Well, that's a good one, too, because that's the most common argument that people give. Let me just call it the argument from design, whether it's intelligent or not. When you ask people, even the most pious believer who says they believe because of faith, will end up giving you a reason for why they believe, and they should. I mean, and that's good that they do. And that reason is usually design in the universe. They look around and they say, how can this thing have happened naturally? It must have happened supernaturally. Well, first of all, that's a bad argument. It's an illogical argument because they don't know how something happened. That doesn't mean it had to happen supernaturally. But beyond that, if you are a scientist and you look at the universe in greater detail than a scientist does than the average person, you find the universe just doesn't look designed. It looks exactly as it should be if it wasn't designed. There's no evidence for design in life. There's no evidence for design in cosmology. And in fact, as I said, the characteristics that you find are just what you would expect if there was no God.
I think a person of faith might argue that just because we can't find evidence for God, that doesn't prove that he doesn't exist. The usual absence of evidence isn't evidence for absence at all.
Well, yeah, there's two things I want to say about that. First of all, I totally disagree with that statement. Absence of evidence is evidence for absence. We don't have evidence for Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, so we don't believe in them. And we don't have evidence for God. Why should we believe in them? But beyond that, I claim there is evidence against God. That's what I'm talking about here. It's not just a matter of absence of evidence. It's a matter of the God hypothesis making testable predictions that don't bear up under observation.
Victor Stenger is Professor Emeritus of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Hawaii and a philosopher at the University of Colorado. His book is God, the Failed Hypothesis. But while Victor Stenger maintains that there's no testable evidence for God, either in scripture or cosmology, mathematical physicist Frank Tipler disagrees. We spoke to Professor Tipler, the author most recently of The Physics of Christianity.
Now, in order to understand whether Christianity is true, we first of all have to have an argument for the existence of God. If God does not exist, we're stopped in the tracks. I think we can agree Christianity is false. Agree with that, Seth?
I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Okay, well, let's try. Now, we have to know what this word God means. Well, what I always like to do in deciding what a word means is go to a guy or guys who are recognized over centuries as the leading authority into defining the word. Let's go to St. Thomas Aquinas or the Jewish rabbi Moses Maimonides. How do they define the word God? They say God is the uncaused first cause. Now, a cause, we all know what that means, and of course, physics, we as physicists know exactly what the word cause is. So let's look in the universe and go backwards into time and see if there's a start to all this. We know that there is a start to all this, and that's the Big Bang. Now, if you look at the situation a little bit more in detail mathematically, we find out that the Big Bang is what physicists and mathematicians call a singularity, namely something that is intrinsically infinite and something that is not subject to physical law and finally is outside of space and time altogether. It itself, we can see, has no cause. It is rather the cause of all causes.
But Frank, Victor Stenger in his book points to the Big Bang as proof that there could not be a God, or at least the kind of God, that concerns himself with the affairs of humankind, because he says the Big Bang was totally chaotic. All the information about what might have existed beforehand has been scrambled, and that the Big Bang is in fact disproof of God. How do you see it as a proof of God?
Because what Stenger says is mathematically false. Now, what you can prove using the laws of physics is that the initial singularity, that's the beginning of time, that is outside of time, that's the uncaused first cause, which we are told is God, that actually was an extremely regular state. Now, from that, we can deduce that the entire structure of the singularity basically communicates with us as a person. Now, describing in detail how that works requires a book, which, of course, I've written.
Well, then let's take an example where maybe how science might be able to weigh in on maybe the virgin birth. How could science deal with a virgin birth?
Well, we first of all ask, can virgin births occur in human beings? Now, what we've been observing over the past two centuries when we've been studying biology, we've discovered virgin births occurring in more and more complicated animals. Back in the 19th century, they thought the virgin births were restricted to insects. We now know that we've seen many cases of virgin births occurring in reptiles and even some cases of virgin births occurring in birds. We've not yet seen it in mammals, but it's very easy to prove that a virgin birth occurs because all the genetic information has to be in the mother, that's in the child. So for about a $200 DNA test, we can easily see if a virgin birth actually occurs. That is, a birth that occurs without the influence of a male. It's very easy to determine. Now, if we had a sample of Jesus' DNA, we could then determine whether he was a virgin birth or not. There is an object which has been claimed to contain Jesus' blood, namely the Shroud of Turin, which is claimed to be the burial cloth which wrapped Jesus in the tomb, and also a cloth called the Oviedo cloth, which was claimed to be the face cloth that was used to wipe blood off of Jesus' face. Now, it turns out that some leading Italian DNA experts conducted a DNA test on this, the blood of the Shroud of Turin and the Oviedo cloth. They didn't know how to interpret the data. It didn't make sense to them. But it makes sense to me because it is the signature I had predicted for a virgin birth of a male.
Does that prove, then, that Christian theology is true, or simply that this story could be compatible with events that are compatible with science? You've already pointed out that many species show this kind of virgin birth syndrome. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't that also be compatible with, if you will, a non-religious view, just an accident of biology?
Well, I agree with this, but remember, in the Christian tradition, miracles do not violate physical law. The theological argument is God knew in the beginning what he wants to accomplish in universal history. He adjusted the laws of physics accordingly, so they will carry out his purposes. So he does not have to set aside his own laws. It is only in an improbable event from the human standpoint.
Frank, do you think that this investigation of yours, where you're trying to use the tools of science to validate Christianity, could that be applied to other religious beliefs, or is there something special about Christianity?
There's something special about Christianity because what's coming out of the physics is a three-part structure to the singularity, i.e. God, and of course Christianity is one of the few religions, I know of only one other, that asserts God is triune. Hinduism also asserts God is triune, but it has built into it, Hinduism does, notion of eternal return, so the universe exists forever. We now know from observation that it has only existed for 14 billion years, so of the two, it seems to me very clear that Christianity is selected as the true religion.
So it is special.
Definitely.
Finally, Frank,
it comes out entirely from the physics.
Well, if you have succeeded in proving your thesis here, it strikes me that that's certainly one of the biggest stories of the century.
Well, we're only a little into the century, right? So, we will hope it's true that we have a physical theory that can describe everything, and the consequences are that God exists, that he is triune, and that Christianity is true.
Frank Tipler, thank you very much for talking with me.
My pleasure, Seth.
Frank Tipler is professor of mathematical physics at Tulane University.
No, there's nothing wrong with your radio or iPod, at least not that I can tell, but that's the sound of the altimeter on the Huygens probe as it was dropped from the Cassini spacecraft down onto the surface of Titan, Saturn's smoggy, foggy moon. It began at an altitude of 1,270 kilometers and, in the course of 3 minutes, had to decelerate from 18,000 to 1,400 kilometers per hour. Then parachutes slowed it to a turtle space of a mere 300 kilometers an hour, and then it hit. In its brief celebrated existence on Titan, Huygens opened a window onto an exotic world. It provided data on this moon's unique atmosphere chemistry, such as the methane rain and the possibility of ethane snowflakes, and the first photographs of its craggy, ice-strewn surface. The success of the Huygens probe is just one offshoot of the Cassini mission that has been supplying scientists with more data than you can shake a laser pointer at. After a 7-year journey, Cassini has beamed back stunning close-ups of Saturn's rings, revealed the existence of an entirely new ring, and while looking at Enceladus, another moon, up close, finding geysers spewing liquid water. For Carolyn Porco, the Cassini imaging team leader, who also worked on the Voyager mission, these revelations, supplied by the tools of science, occasioned what she calls a religious experience. And she says that she found science after a spiritual quest. She began by sharing her highlights of the Cassini mission.
Saturn is a very phenomenologically rich planetary system. It itself is a body as complex as Jupiter. It has a complex, large magnetosphere. It has one of the largest collections of moons. It has 47 moons. I mean, that's one whopping system of bodies right there. And then it has it's got the solar system's largest set of rings, you know, kind of the granddaddy of all ring systems. So it's very rich for studying many of the same questions that we have about the origin of planetary systems and solar systems in general.
And now these images of Saturn came back, and they were printed all in the papers, and they were really spectacular. I know there was incredible public reaction. What was it like for you when you first saw these pictures?
My reaction to our pictures is probably identical to the reaction that anyone else has when looking at these images. It's first and foremost an emotional response for me. They are, by definition, otherworldly, and that's why they're so captivating. And the ones that I tend to like the best, actually, are our black and white ones. I mean, the ones before we've made them into color. You know, they're moody and mysterious, and I just love them. I love the ones where the ring shadows are being cast on the northern hemisphere of the planet, and there's a moon here or there. It just really gives me this kind of supernatural feeling, you know, of floating around in the Saturn system, which is why I personally am involved in this kind of an activity, because it's a way to be there without really being there.
Well, it's obviously a profound experience for you, and I want to say religious. I'm hesitant to use that word because it seems very difficult to talk about things that are profound in science and also use the word religion or even use the word spirituality, but I have a feeling that in your case it applies. And from what I understand, you got into science through religion, and I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how that happened.
Well, okay. When I was a young teenager, I just was very introspective about, you know, the meaning of life, all those big questions. And I thought a lot about it. I was very interested in what religions had to say about it, what philosophy had to say about it, and I read about Eastern religions, I read existentialism, and I just was very curious about it. Also, bear in mind, this might have something to do with it, that I was a young teenager in the 1960s, and so young people were turning to the East. You know, so it wasn't very unusual maybe for me to be thinking this way, but I was.
I think it is unusual for young people to be asking these big questions at times and also to be not accepting what they're taught, which it sounds like you had a whole line of questioning on your own that was something different from what you were being taught.
Well, the religion I was born into was Catholicism, and I did go to a Catholic high school, but I completely rejected the whole religious aspect of it. I went to the school I went to because it was a good academic institution, and I was, I might add, always in trouble because I was rejecting religion. But nonetheless, I was, you know, thinking along those lines. You know, the quest, the big quest, the meaning of life. What am I doing here? What are we here for? What's the purpose of it all? And at some point, I turned from being introspective to thinking about the big out there and what is out there, you know? It was kind of a looking inward, turning from a looking inward to a looking out. And I became very interested in astronomy and what astronomy and the study of the cosmos had to say about this issue. For me, it's a way to become involved in something and be a part of something that is vastly bigger than I am. And I think this is exactly what religious people get out of their religion. They feel a connection to something very much bigger than them. They call it God. Well, I don't believe in a God per se. I do believe in, you know, what it is that science has revealed to us. And, you know, for me to be a scientist and to find something basic, something fundamental about the way the world works, you know, is like signing my name to the Great Declaration of Human Thought. It's just an immense privilege.
Some people who have the same questions are content with the theological answers, and you turn to science, and I wonder why science? I mean, why did you feel you needed to go a bit further into astronomy? Because many religions present those answers already.
Because I never, even as a child, I was attracted to the aspect of science which does not accept blindly the authority of any one particular person or group of people. You know, nature, in science, nature is the final arbiter. You know, nature will decide who's right and who's wrong. It's not someone's opinion. It's not some sacred text. It's the objectivity in science that I've always been attracted to. And I want the truth. You know, it's like John Lennon, one of my great heroes, you know, give me some truth. I want the truth. I don't want to spend my life under some delusion. I mean, that would be a tremendous tragedy to me, to live your whole life deluding yourself into thinking something was true that wasn't. I mean, that is the pits. You know, that's the ultimate tragedy. I want to know the truth, and so science is the best mechanism I know of for getting at the truth.
Do you think that science is as democratic, perhaps, if that's the right word, as religion is, available to people? I mean, anybody can adopt a religion and a religious philosophy. Do you think that the scientific method and the scientific questions that scientists have are also as available to general people?
Well, the answer is yes, it is. Of course, you know, understand that to practice this requires training. I mean, you have to be trained in the approach, because the approach is a very special approach. You know, this whole idea of forming a hypothesis and then testing it against reality, and the discipline involved in accepting what your experiments or what your mathematical equations tell you is something that you have to be trained in. Even Einstein screwed up once or twice in this regard, not wanting to accept what his mathematical derivations had told him. It's something that is very demanding. But yes, it is entirely democratic. It doesn't matter if you're male, if you're female, what religious faith you practice, you know, what side of the tracks you were born on. And there's no one person whose opinion matters more than anyone else's. As I said, nature is the final arbiter.
Carolyn Porco is the imaging team leader of NASA's Cassini mission.
Coming up, hello, madam, I'm Adam, and this is my pet dinosaur. Dinosaurs meet Adam and Eve in a new creation museum.
Plus, whether religion is good or bad may be beside the point. An anthropologist says its expression is inevitable. It's deity meets data on Are We Alone? From the SETI Institute.
Hi, I'm Megha Sethyanarayana, And whether you side with the cloth or the lab coat, you'll want to become a Team SETI member. It's easy. Just go to the SETI Institute website, www.seti.org, and sign up. The cost is minimal. You support the exciting research of scientists at the SETI Institute, and you'll get our nifty full-color magazine, The Explorer. When you do join Team SETI, please send an email to the radio show so we can send you something to cherish. A personally autographed photo of Seth, Molly, and Barbara Vance. These prints are charming. Perfect for swatting down hornets' nests or used by beginning origamers. And for those of you who have joined Team SETI and let us know, thank you. Keep an eye on your mailbox.
Welcome back to Are We Alone?
Recently, a new museum opened in Petersburg, Kentucky, depicting the history of creation. It has everything you'd expect: dinosaurs, fossils, reconstructed archaeological sites, live exhibits of birds and reptiles, and a few rarities, such as the miniature Adam and Eve standing next to the dinosaurs, geological evidence of Noah's flood, and a planetarium that argues for a 6,000-year-old universe. Welcome to the Creation Museum, a $27 million natural history museum based on the book of Genesis. Reporter Gordy Slack was there for opening day. He recently covered the trial in Dover, Pennsylvania, which floated the question of whether an intelligent design theory could ever be science. Now he's discovered what happens when the Bible weighs in as well.
Gordy, I take it that a lot of people came out to the Creation Museum opening.
Yes, they did, Molly. The line was out the door and across the yard.
In fact, you collected some tape while you were there, so let's just hear from one woman who was standing in line.
It feels pretty nice to have something that is for God and about God. Instead of all the evolution and things, this is what we would like to see.
So, Gordy, who was that woman?
She was just a visitor to the museum. She'd come with her husband. He had a big American flag on his shirt, or his shirt was made out of a kind of American flag with an eagle on it. And they were sort of your typical Creation Museum visitors from Lansing, Michigan.
Was her response typical of other visitors to the museum?
Yeah, a lot of people were expressing relief that they'd finally found a place where they could feel at home. And according to recent polls, about 40% of Americans will feel perfectly at home in this museum.
That's an amazing number, to know that almost half of Americans would feel at home at the Creation Museum. And so I wonder if you could describe the museum for me to give me a sense of what it would be like once you went through the front door.
Sure. Well, the museum is very familiar to me at first because I grew up in museums like the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And all the characters that you find in those museums, the Tyrannosaurus Rexes and the Stegosauruses and the dioramas with animals and plants, they're all there, except they're arranged in a way that is defined by the book of Genesis in the Bible. So with the dinosaurs, you find standing characters like Adam and Eve and little kids commingling among with the dinosaurs. So it's a natural history-like museum, but it's really telling the story of the Bible, not the natural history of life on Earth as we science-oriented people recognize it.
How is the museum arranged? What is the organizing principle as you walk through it? Is it arranged by chapters in Genesis, for example?
No. Ken Ham, the director of the museum and the president of Answers in Genesis, the group that made the museum, explained to me that it's laid out following what he calls the six C's of history, which are creation, corruption, catastrophe, confusion, Christ, and the final C, which stands for consummation. And those represent the periods of history that Ken Ham sees are played out in the book of Genesis.
I wonder if we can take some of those as an example. You started with creation. How is creation shown in the museum?
Well, creation in the museum is mostly represented in terms of biological creation. I don't think they deal a lot with the physical creation of the world as described in Genesis. But suddenly, on the second day, all of the plants and animals that ever existed exist. And so they've got a diorama that's jam-packed, crowded like a parking lot with dinosaurs and human beings and birds and all kinds of plants. There is a very conspicuous difference between the animals as we know them now and those that are represented in the first period of creation of the museum, and that is that those animals are perfectly benign because, of course, that was before the fall when Adam and Eve, you know, made their mistake. And so that plants don't have thorns on them. All animals are thought to be vegetarian, including people and the T-Rexes that are standing nearby.
So that's why Adam and Eve can actually stand next to the dinosaurs.
That's correct.
Are there any apes in the museum?
I've got to say, Molly, I don't remember seeing a single ape. I think they may have been skirting that issue.
You did talk to the man who designed the dinosaurs. Who was this?
His name is Buddy Davis, and he had been making dinosaurs even before he got involved with Answers in Genesis, and he'd been making them for secular museums and other organizations. And he's an interesting character because he's always been a creationist, and he used to have a sort of guilty pleasure of making dinosaurs that he knew would be used to advance, as he describes it, a secular agenda.
Well, I know that it's here that it can have eternal values for good. That's the way I want my dinosaurs to be viewed. Just like God made all the other animals, he created the dinosaurs too. And I just think that the teaching in the other museums is designed to take people away from God. And that's not what I want. I want to bring people to the Lord. As I see this nation falling away from God, I don't see it getting better. I think when America was the strongest is when we had strong Christian leaders that were not afraid to take a stand on God's Word and not ashamed for what the Bible says. And it means a lot more to me seeing the dinosaurs here than any other museum around the world that would be teaching a view that I would not agree with at all.
He's a creationist.
That's right.
Do you think he had any problem creating dinosaurs for natural history museums that depicted evolution through science?
I think he was very uncomfortable doing that, yes. And he's much more at home in this museum.
Now, how does the museum tackle the question of fossils? Because there are some fossils in the museum. How does it explain fossils?
Well, apparently, according to Ken Ham, the fossil evidence that we see on Earth is the byproduct of the Great Flood. You remember Noah and his ship. And when he was told by God to make that ship and warned that there was going to be 40 days of rain and everything would get flooded, apparently, that, according to these guys, that really did happen. Every living thing except fishes and other sea-dwelling things was destroyed and killed except for the animals on the ark. And when the water settled out after the 40 days and 40 nights, fossils were created and things were distributed around based on, you know, where they were when the flood came and how they floated and how they tried to escape the flood running up hills and so forth. So all the topography and geology that we see on Earth, according to this Answers in Genesis view, is really the byproduct of that great big flood.
Now, the museum was built by Ken Ham. As you said, he runs an organization called Answers in Genesis. What is that?
Answers in Genesis is a huge organization. I think they've got 300 employees that work out of the same building as the museum, and they're devoted to what they call biblical apologetics, which means they just argue for a literal interpretation of the Bible, and they send people around on lectures across the country. They have a radio station that's got 860 stations worldwide, I think. And they publish a lot of books and videotapes and CDs.
Let's hear what Ken Ham has to say about the museum.
It's really a debate about your beliefs about the past. Because really, we all have the same science when it comes to empirical science. And we really do. I mean, we study the same genetics as a geneticist. We have a molecular geneticist on staff. And she even got her PhD from a secular university. You know, I was a science teacher accredited by my university to teach science in the public school. So they believed I taught science. And my kids passed their exams. So I must have taught science. So, see, it's not really a debate over that. It's really a debate. This whole issue of origins is so different to talking about, you know, putting man on the moon and so on. I know a number of creation scientists that work at NASA. Some have worked on the Hubble telescope. Some have worked on the space shuttle. They're creationists like me. And their belief in origins doesn't affect the technology of building the space shuttle, but it affects how you interpret what you see out there in relation to the past. That's the difference.
Right. And what is the bigger debate over? Is it really over our interpretations of the evidence, or is it really over the meaning of life?
It's over both, I would say. It's certainly over the interpretations of the evidence in relation to the past, not in relation to the present. I mean, when I dig up a dinosaur bone in the present, say, I found a dinosaur bone here in the present, we all agree on that interpretation. But when we say, and it existed millions of years ago, now that's the interpretation we're going to disagree on. We actually all have the same evidence. So the disagreement is not over evidence. The disagreement is over your interpretations. But the reason we have different interpretations is because we have different different starting points. We start with the Bible, make no apology about that. Others start with their belief that science only explains things by natural processes, which is a belief. You know, many people, I've had the secular press ask me, they say, but you're not prepared to change your belief in the Bible, whereas at least evolutionists are prepared to change their ideas. I say, wait a minute, they're prepared to change their models, they're not prepared to change their belief that life is a result of natural processes.
Right.
You see, so we both have different starting points, and we're telling people boldly, the starting point we have is the right one.
So it sounds like, according to him, there was a need for this museum.
Absolutely. According to Ken Ham, the natural history museums that we have now across the country misrepresent both the truth about the world, but also they make it very difficult for people to continue believing in the Bible, which I think he believes is part of the motivation of those people behind those museums.
And what's your take on all of this? Is there anything wrong with creating a creation museum?
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose there wouldn't be anything wrong with it if it were just a museum about the Bible. But the problem arises for me when they suggest that the story that it tells is literally true, and when they suggest that they're relying on modern science to validate their interpretation of world history, which is clearly way, way, way off the mark.
There were some attending the opening who agreed with you. One was Lawrence Krauss. He's a physicist at Case Western Reserve University, and you caught up with him in the crowd?
Well, he wasn't actually in the crowd. He was outside the gates. The museum is very well guarded, and outside the gates there was a demonstration of freethinkers and atheists, and Lawrence Krauss was among them. And there was an airplane pulling a banner that they had commissioned to fly overhead that said, "Thou shalt not lie."
I'm here to speak out against a museum which is really a museum of anti-science.
But how do we know where to draw the boundary of what we count as science? Even if we're drawing that boundary at the edge of the natural world,
oh, absolutely.
Isn't what constitutes the natural world always shifting? I mean, hasn't it?
Well, no, the natural world is the natural world. What we know about it
shifts. What we know about it shifts.
But here's the difference. If it's not falsifiable, it's not science. That's why, in fact, I'm against many scientists who speak out against religion. I don't think science has anything to say about religion. Science doesn't have anything to say about questions of purpose in the universe. And science deals with natural phenomena, and it's based on the fact that natural causes can be explained, natural effects can be explained by natural causes. It's that simple. And it's worked so well that it's a shame that four centuries after Galileo, we're here still having people who feel that knowledge is so dangerous that they have to protect children from it.
What do you feel is the danger, the particular danger posed here by this museum?
Well, you know, if this were just a little museum in Kentucky that no one was interested in, it would just be laughable. But there are media from all around the world who've come to visit it, first of all. Secondly, when you poll the American public, 45% of the American adults think the world is 10,000 years old, even though it isn't. And the danger is, I think the reason people feel that way is they somehow feel that if they don't feel that way, they're atheists. And they think that science is akin to atheism, and it isn't. And that's the message that this museum gives. If you don't believe the world is 6,000 years old, then you have to be an atheist. It's as much of a disservice to people of faith who have understood that. I talk here, who have understood that since the time of St. Augustine. That religion can't disagree with the results of science because the results of science tell us how the world works.
Gordy, what does this museum represent? This was a well-funded museum. $27 million went into it. By all accounts, from what you've written about in Ceylon, it is actually a beautiful museum, so there was a lot of money. From what we've heard, almost half of the United States is interested in a museum like this or would feel at home in a museum like this. So what's going on?
Well, 10 years ago, when I started covering this beat, I never would have guessed that there'd be a creation museum in 2007. I think that the ascendancy of the political right, the Christian wing of the political right, is a big part of it. Creationists have come out of the closet. It's become acceptable to become a creationist. There are a lot of famous ones, a lot of, you know, as you know, three of the Republican candidates vying for the nomination in the Republican Party are creationists or don't believe in evolution anyway, and it's just become a normal thing in America to be a creationist. Now, I don't think the numbers are probably any higher than they ever were, but somehow it's become politically and culturally acceptable to identify yourself as a creationist.
Well, what is it about evolution that is so distasteful to almost half the American population?
Well, if Ken Ham is representative of that one half that find evolution repugnant. It's because it makes God, I believe it's because it makes God unnecessary. As Richard Dawkins says, evolution doesn't prove that God doesn't exist, but he does make him unnecessary. So if you can explain the evolution of life, the multiplication of forms and so forth, without reference to a God, then you really don't need that God. And I think that these creationists at the Creation Museum are relying on a God that we need.
Gordy Slack is a science writer in Oakland, California. His book is The Battle Over the Meaning of Everything, Evolution, Intelligent Design, and a School Board in Dover, Pennsylvania. His article on the Creation Museum can be found at Salon.com. Well, maybe you have no plans to make the Creation Museum your next vacation destination, and you might disagree with the biblical commentary on the theory of evolution, but if science has any say, one thing is clear. Religion, at least, is here to stay. According to anthropologist Lewis Wolpert, our brains are hardwired to believe what he calls irrational religiosity. It's as much a tool for humanity as a hammer or a computer in helping us to make our way in the world. Our belief system is what separates us from the other mammals. But, says Dr. Wolpert, that doesn't mean you should stop questioning the truth of one's faith. Molly recently spoke with him at a conference in Durham, England, called Darwin, Science, and Belief.
Now, you argue that religion has an evolutionary advantage. What is that advantage?
I think people who are religious do better. Well, there is evidence that the people with religious beliefs are a bit happier and a bit healthier than those who don't have such beliefs. And I think the reason for that is that, and I see it, I have a son who became religious when he was doing very badly, and it helped him a great deal. And I think many religious people feel it's reassuring to know that there's an afterlife, that they may go to heaven, that it can provide explanations for all sorts of things like the nature of the world, why perhaps sometimes they get ill. And I think it gives them a confidence about the way the world works that those who are not religious do not have. And it provides explanations for many of the mysteries of the nature of the world.
So are you also suggesting what the origins of religious belief are, not only why they're prevalent today, but how they originated?
I think that's the origin of beliefs about religion, that people developed, evolved causal beliefs in relation to tool making. And technology and tool making, I think, drove human evolution. And
then you say causal beliefs. What does that mean?
By causal beliefs, I mean about physical interactions in the world, that if I take the stone and hit it here, I know where it's going to break up, that I can throw a stone at an animal and I know that I will damage it. It's not about moral beliefs, about cause and effect. And animals are really rather bad about this. People I know think their cats and dogs are very clever, but they do not have good causal beliefs, nor do chimpanzees. They're at the beginning of it. And once people had causal beliefs, they wanted to understand the causes of things that affected their lives, like death, illness, the climate, and things like that. And the most natural explanation was that there was some sort of human-like person who did this.
So the idea is that we can't stand or we can't tolerate not knowing what the reason is for something.
We cannot tolerate not knowing the causes of things that affect our lives, and we will always make up a story as to why something happened, or desperate to find out. People who lose a relative in a plane crash 10 years later will still want to know why that plane crashed. And if you go to the doctor and they tell you what illness you have, on the way home you will tell yourself a story as to why you got ill.
But back on the savannah, if the lion is running towards you, you're not going to pause and wonder if whether a god has sent that lion towards you. There's really no time for that.
And I think we may be genetically determined to respond rather quickly. And I think that's why many of our beliefs are so unreliable, because we make up our minds very quickly, because precisely for the reason that you give, you couldn't sit around thinking when someone was thinking or when you were going hungry where your food was going to come. You had to act quickly.
Yes. But how is that extended to the supernatural world, let's say back on the savannah, this mythical savannah scene that I'm setting up? How is this extended to a supernatural being in the sky who's manipulating things like marionettes?
Well, the one cause we or our ancestor were absolutely sure of was a human cause. We know that. I know I can punch you on the nose. I know I can scratch my face. I know I can throw a stone. And therefore it seemed most plausible that the causes of things was some sort of human-like, had some sort of human-like origin, and that's the origin of gods, I would claim. Now, there may be people on the savannah who don't believe in gods, but there will be spirits, there will be sorcerers, there will be some sort of magic. They provide explanations which nothing else provides.
And that comforts us, so it's really appealing to our emotions.
Oh, it's appealing to our emotions. We cannot tolerate not knowing. If I'm worried whether my partner is being unfaithful to me or has been unfaithful, I will want to know the reason why. If my children are doing badly, I don't want to bore you. And if you just look at young children, how many questions they ask about what causes what. And there are studies of even adult conversation, what percentage of the conversation is about cause and effect, a larger amount.
In fact, you were talking about this development of causal beliefs, and you don't see it in chimpanzees, but you do see it emerge at very predictable stages with young children.
Oh, young children have a concept of cause and effect within a few months of being born, and it really is innate and genetically determined. I know some psychologists don't like talking like that, but my psychologists at my place certainly do.
So, for example, if you take a toy and you pass it behind a screen, a child will look to the other side of the screen expecting that to appear.
Absolutely. And if there were a hole and it appeared and it didn't pass, you didn't see it pass through the hole, they'd be totally puzzled. They know that if an object moves and they can't see what's causing it to move, they will stare at it much longer. They're puzzled by it.
Whereas perhaps a cat or a cricket might not do that.
Cats and crickets, they're very nice, and dogs, and I love my dogs, but they don't understand these things. No, and no animal, incidentally, could play billiards, cricket, or golf, because that requires a very deep understanding of physical cause and effect.
Except crickets might be able to play crickets.
No, I'm afraid not even crickets can play cricket.
Okay. So you're going on the record to say crickets probably don't believe in God.
Crickets don't believe in God, no. But I don't think crickets have belief.
Now, you said, though, that it has a survival advantage, but really, if I were to stand back on the savannah and believe that God was going to protect me from the lion running towards me,
no,
I would be dinner.
No, I don't think that people ever were so silly as to think that God would protect them from the lion when the lion's running towards them. What they would believe that God would, on the whole, keep lions away from them. But occasionally, because they had done something wrong, he would let a lion come to them. That would be the explanation. But in the immediate effect, you don't turn to God, you learn from experience. God does not want you to be eaten.
So religion, or the belief in religion, has had a survival value, and it's been selected for over time?
I think we have mystical minds because those with religious beliefs were selected and did better.
We're talking about religion now,
yes.
But that would that also extend to other supernatural beliefs, beliefs in lucky numbers, or beliefs in gods and spirits, ghosts, all of that?
I think it's all related. We do have mystical minds, and when people take LSD and have these extraordinary experiences, it cannot be this boring molecule that does it. It means the circuits are there in our brain.
I believe you said, I think you used the word gene, and I'm wondering if you're saying we're genetically disposed towards belief, but you're not saying there's a gene for belief.
No. First of all, there isn't a gene for belief. There will be thousands of genes determining one's beliefs. But I do think that we are genetically, the genes have determined that we have circuits in our brain which are really quite mystical. And that's why when you take LSD or magic mushroom or these things, you have these extraordinary experiences.
No, but you wouldn't go so far on the subject of religion now to say that there is no advantage to religion. In fact, you're arguing just the opposite. There is an advantage to religion, whereas some scientists today will say that there is not an advantage to religion. In fact, it's maladaptive for civilized society.
I think that that's wrong. I think so for many people. Religion is greatly reassuring. I think religious societies help each other a great deal. And I think for many people, religion is a great advantage now, yes.
And yet you yourself are not religious. Is that germane to this conversation?
Well, I'm an atheist, and that was because when I was a child, I prayed to God and he didn't give me what I wanted. So I gave it up. And there are about half the people in this country are not religious, but in America it's just the other way. It's 80-90% are religious. Just why people give up religion is not a simple question. I don't have a good answer.
But actually that's not the reason why, if I can just assert myself into your personal life, that's not actually the reason, as I understand, you don't believe in God. You've gone on the record saying there is actually no scientific evidence for God.
I'm afraid as a scientist I know of no evidence whatsoever for the existence of God. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
So what's interesting is you're saying that religion, the belief in religion, is rational in some ways, yet it's based on an irrational basis. There's no evidence for God scientifically, but yet there's something very rational about believing that there is.
I don't think there's anything rational. I think it's quite emotional. It's quite a sensible way of providing explanations about things for which you have no explanation.
So then finally, then why does religion prevail in the face of science? I mean, if really what we're looking for is something to calm us down so we have an explanation for things, now we know why apples fall to the ground. It has to do with gravity. It doesn't have to do with some god maybe drawing it towards the earth. We have science, so why does religion prevail?
Because science goes against common sense. Any scientific view of the way the world works goes against common sense. Come on, gravity doesn't make common sense, that there's something pulling us down like that. Or when you're going at 400 miles an hour at constant speed in an aeroplane, there's no force on you. That force causes acceleration, not motion, is totally counterintuitive. Every scientific idea goes against common sense, and that's why we go to all these other magical ones.
So you think religion will probably be around for a long time?
I think religion will be around forever.
That is a long time. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you very much.
Lewis Wolpert is professor of biology as applied to medicine in the Department of Anatomy and Developmental Biology at University College London, and he's a fellow of the Royal Society.
And that's it for our show. You've been listening to Deity Meets Data on Are We Alone? From the SETI Institute. Thanks to Barbara Vance and Megha Satyanarayana for their help in the show's production. Are We Alone? Is made possible by support from the NASA Astrobiology Institute. We invite you to find out more. Just go to our website, radio.seti.org. I'm Seth Shostak.
And I'm Molly Bentley for the SETI Institute, whose mission is to understand the nature and origin of life in the universe. We always listen, but sometimes we broadcast.
This is recording, Molly. Okay. Deity Meets Data, Part 1. Science and Religion. Stephen Jay Gould once...
Very good.
All right, I'll take it. Science and religion, Stephen Jay Gould once said, were separate magisteria, distinct realms of human understanding. Science tells us how the natural world... Hello.